So it's all here. The story of our time with the bar call.
That was President Lyndon Baines Johnson upon the dedication of his presidential library in 1971. Since then, the library has provided a forum to explore not only the presidency of Lyndon Johnson, but the American presidency in general.
As we continue this podcast, we'll examine the lives of many of the 45 men who have held the presidency and the impact they've had on our nation and beyond. We'll talk with some of the country's best historians who will look past the legends and shed revealing light on presidential lives and legacies with The Bark Off.
I'm Mark Updegrove.
And I'm Mark Lawrence. Hello, everyone, and welcome. My guest today is Kai Bird, author of the new biography, The Outlier, The Unfinished Presidency of Jimmy Carter. This extraordinary book examines the 39th president with unprecedented depth as well as balance, highlighting President Carter's great achievements as well as the shortcomings that made him a one-term president. Kai Bird is the executive director of the Leon Levy Center for Biography and a highly acclaimed author with several biographies to his credit. These include The Color of Truth, McGeorge and William Bundy, and The American Prometheus, The Triumph and Tragedy of J. Robert Oppenheimer, for which Kai Bird won the Pulitzer Prize. Kai Bird, welcome, and thanks so much for making time to be with us today. Let's jump right in and talk about your choice of Jimmy Carter as a biographical subject. You've written several other biographies. What drew you to this most enigmatic, I think I can say, of American presidents?
Well, that's a funny story. Actually, I was first drawn to the notion of writing a biography of Jimmy Carter in 1990, after I was finishing my first big biography called The Chairman, a biography of John McCloy, who actually features in the Carter administration. But I'll come back to that in a moment. Anyway, as I was winding down on that project, I thought, well, maybe I should try a president. And I'd always been intrigued by Carter, curious about him. So to explore the notion of doing this big book in 1990, I got myself down to Atlanta, and I had a magazine assignment with The Nation magazine to do a profile of Carter and what he was doing with his ex-presidency. I thought this would be a good way to sort of explore the notion of a biography. And, I got a chance to interview Carter on the phone and interviewed a bunch of his people at the Carter Center. And this was, literally just 10 years after he had left the White House. And I ended up writing a 5,000-word profile about what a great ex-president he was turning out to be. But I came away from the experience realizing that the South was a foreign country. That I didn't understand race and the South. I didn't understand religion and Southern Baptists. And that Carter was sort of really, well, as you say, an enigma. And that to really do such a book, I came back and told my wife that I'd have to move to Plains, Georgia. We'd have to go to South Georgia and seep into South Georgia like a foreign correspondent would. And my wife said, well, goodbye, I'm not moving to South Georgia. So I backed off from the project, but I was, really still curious always about Carter. And several books later, I came back to it, maybe with some more hubris or confidence. And having said that, I started in 2015 on this Carter book, and it took me 6 years, and I'm still not sure I understand the South.
Well, it seems to me you come to a fascinating understanding of Jimmy Carter that's neatly encapsulated in your title, The Outlier. Tell us what you mean by that term.
Well, I think it's a perfect title. It's punchy and short, and it describes Jimmy Carter. He was not only an outlier as a president or ex-president, but even growing up in South Georgia in Plains and Archery, South Georgia, this little hamlet outside of Plains, he was a strange little boy who didn't fit the normal stereotypes of a white boy in South Georgia. He grew up among blacks. All his friends were African Americans as a child. So he really had a very easygoing understanding and relationship with African Americans. And he was, because of his mother, he was a liberal on racial issues, unlike his father, who was a believer in white supremacy. And so Carter just, you know, he was also an outlier in terms of his intelligence, his curiosity, his determination. And I think there's sort of a distinction between outlier and outsider. He was part of South Georgia. He's a Southern man, but he's an outlier in that culture. And that's what's sort of a mystery about him, how this guy from this tiny hamlet in South Georgia could make it to the White House. And it's a fabulous story.
The bulk of the book is focused, of course, on the presidency, but you do include a few chapters at the beginning about his early life. And as you say, one of the striking things is his unusual thinking about race, which you've just touched on. It seems to me he was also unusual for his attitudes toward politics and specifically toward the New Deal, toward liberalism. Could you talk a little bit about the ways in which he may have been an outlier in this respect as well?
Yes. Yeah, no, he was very hard for sort of liberal Yankees like myself to pin down. You know, he was a liberal on racial issues. He was a populist in an economic sense. He, you know, both as a governor and as a president, his instincts were to try to spend money on poor people. But he had a suspicion, sort of a small town fiscal conservative kind of suspicion of big government and federal programs. So he wasn't a classic New Dealer. You know, he was an admirer of Franklin Roosevelt. His mother, Miss Lillian, who I argue gave him his sort of political sensibilities, admired Roosevelt. His father did not. So again, there's this dichotomy. But so Jimmy comes into the White House and his instinct is to have zero-based budgeting. His instinct is to be suspicious of pork barrel legislation. So he early in his presidency, he canceled all these water projects that congressmen, whether Republican or Democrat, were assuming that a Democratic president would approve of. And no, Jimmy vetoed it because he wanted to save money and he thought it was a waste. So he was hard for a congressman like the Speaker of the House, Tip O'Neill. Tip O'Neill couldn't, you know, was scratching his head all the time, trying to figure out what made Carter tick. Because he did have these instincts to help the poor and the disadvantaged, but he was a fiscal conservative, so he wanted to balance the federal budget. And that's not at all what Tip O'Neill had in mind in 1977.
You know, as always with biography, it seems to me it's important to inquire into the biographical subject's relationship with his or her parents. Talk a little bit more, if you would, about Jimmy Carter's parents, and I think especially about Miss Lillian, who clearly had the deepest impact on young Jimmy.
Miss Lillian, you know, some Americans of a certain generation fondly remember her performances on Johnny Carson and other late night talk shows, which really sort of captured her humor, her frankness, her blunt speaking style. You know, she famously when he was inaugurated in January of 77, at one point right after he takes the oath of office, reporters crowd around Miss Lillian and ask, one of them asks, Miss Lillian, are you proud of your son? And her response was, which one? Anyway, she was a lively, sort of woman who came from a certain, another Southern tradition of allowing eccentric Southern ladies to say what they think and to violate all the social norms. And that's exactly what she did. Growing up, you know, she was a nurse. And when Jimmy Carter was growing up as a young boy in Plains, she was often working out of the house. And she emphasized to him that the races were equal. And she allowed his African-American playmates to come into their house, which was, you know, a taboo in white society at the time. And yet her husband, James Earl Carter, he, you know, he was a white supremacist openly, a segregationist, who disapproved of having any blacks in the house. He was a businessman who was had a good touch with money and knew how to take his farm products to the market and start little businesses. But he was also sort of very old-fashioned. He was a disciplinarian. And young Jimmy Carter sort of, you know, feared him, feared his disciplining. And so, again, there's this stark contrast between the two parents. And yet, when Carter went off to the Navy for 7 years and then suddenly got a call one day that his father was seriously ill, dying, in fact, of pancreatic cancer, he comes back and spends many hours at his bedside and sees a trail of African-American and poor white farmers coming in, thanking his father for having all the little good deeds that he had done. And Jimmy sort of realized that his father was, you know, something more than the tough disciplinarian, that he had a soft side. And when he died, Carter shocked everyone, most prominently his wife, Rosalind Carter, who also had grown up in Plains and loved getting out of Plains, when he decided to abandon his Navy career and move back to Plains to take over the family business, the farm, the peanut warehouse.
A great deal, it seems to me, is always made of Jimmy Carter's religious convictions. How would you describe the core of his religious outlook?
Well, he's, you know, famously born again. And I struggled in the book to sort of figure out what that meant. And I think it actually meant that he read a few books on philosophy and theology. Most prominently, he read a book by Reinhold Niebuhr, who was a famous Protestant theologian living at the time, who was not a Southern Baptist. But Niebuhr helped Carter to sort of close the growing sort of gap between his religious beliefs and his political ambitions. And Niebuhr argued that politicians and leaders, in order to do good, have to achieve power. And they have to make tough political decisions at times. But this is all to the good if they actually use their power to the greater good and to make righteous decisions. And so this helped to sort of bridge the contradictions in Carter's own personality, where he had been raised in the Southern Baptist Church. He was a devout believer. But he had this terrible ambition. I mean, he was ruthless in a certain political sense. You know, Hunter Thompson, the wild and crazy Rolling Stone correspondent, famously described him as the meanest politician he'd ever encountered. Now, that's not your normal picture of Jimmy Carter.
Yeah.
But he is a man who is driven by ambition. And so it was very important for him to discover Reinhold Niebuhr, and particularly in 1966, when he ran and lost in his first effort to become governor of Georgia, lost to a segregationist. He plunged into a deep depression. He had not a nervous breakdown, but a crisis of faith. Yeah. And this is, I believe, what he refers to when he said that he had a born-again experience. He confronted his faith and his political ambitions and found a way to merge them.
You hit a moment ago on one of the really interesting contradictions about Jimmy Carter, I think. We often think of him as an exceptionally generous, nice person, and yet many people who interacted with him found him quite prickly. Quite combative even at times. Could you talk a little bit about that contradiction in Jimmy Carter's personality?
Yeah, you know, he was a tough interview. You know, when I would meet with him in his office at the Carter Center, he would look at his watch as we started, and he typically allocated 45 minutes. And I grew to understand that we weren't going to go over 45 minutes. And he's a hard interview because he's so bright and intelligent, and he's been interviewed so many times that you can see he's bored with the usual question. And while he is very proud of what he accomplished as president, he's not looking back. He was, you know, even when I was interviewing him in his early 90s, he was focused on achieving the good works, the projects that he's pushing at the Carter Center, whether it's wiping out guinea worm disease or bringing peace to the Middle East. And he's not introspective in that way. So, you know, a lot of his answers to my questions were, yes or no, or, well, I can't recall that, or so I'd have to come armed with a lot of long list of questions and documents to show him. And, you know, he those bright blue eyes are very intense and intimidating. He is an intimidating man. He always has been this. He's driven. And he's relentless. And this explains, of course, why he could come from nowhere in 1976 and go on the campaign trail and win the presidency. So you're right. He doesn't fit the sort of the stereotype of what most people think of Jimmy Carter today.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about his rise to political prominence. As you've mentioned, he was an outlier in many ways, not least in his attitude toward race. And yet, in the early stages of his political career, he had to achieve political victories in the state of Georgia. How did he do that? How did he cast himself as a viable politician, given that his ideas were a little bit out of the mainstream?
Yes, well, you know, he was a liberal and a populist, particularly on race and big corporations. But he understood what it was, particularly after losing in the 66 gubernatorial election, he understood what it was going to take for him to achieve victory in 1970. And that meant that he was going to have to appeal to white working class voters who had very conservative racial views. So he really literally walked right up to the red lines. And he did so in a ruthless, opportunistic way, even without ever really crossing the red line. You know? So he would do some dog whistles for white voters, talking about, you know, his admiration, for instance, for their right to send their children to private academies, which were, of course, segregated. Right. At the same time, he was the only Georgia politician who was campaigning in black churches, mm-hmm. and feeling very comfortable doing it. So, you know, again, politically, he did what he thought was necessary to win. And then on the day he was inaugurated as governor, he stood on that platform and shocked the audience by announcing that the time for segregation in the South was over. Mm-hmm. he did a knee bore, you know, he achieved power, and then he turned around right away and did the righteous thing.
And as you chronicle, he began to think about higher office from a relatively early point during his governorship, and under Georgia law, one cannot run for re-election as Georgia governor. So
right.
His mind was increasingly turning to national politics. He was ambitious, and perhaps we've done something to explain why he was interested in continuing to move on to higher and higher positions. But how did he emerge as a serious contender for national office? How can we explain the fact that this outlier emerged as a viable contender in the 1970s?
Well, he was relentless and determined, and he was a good campaigner. But, you know, he never would have made it to the White House if it hadn't been 1976. You know, we were 2 years after Watergate and that scandal. We were just a year after the end of the Vietnam War. And America was going through a crisis of confidence, a crisis of faith in the country and its leadership. And along comes Carter, and he sees sort of the opportunity, a window for saying, you know, what we need is like a Mr. Smith goes to Washington kind of figure, someone without any of the baggage, without any of Washington's baggage, unfettered by big interests, and a moral, decent man of integrity. And so he ran on himself, on his integrity, on his religion, on his honesty, famously arguing, I'll never tell you, never lie to you. Of course, when his closest aide, Charlie Curbo, his longtime lawyer, heard that Carter had incorporated this I'll never lie to you into his stump speech, Curbo, who was very funny, said, well, there goes the liar vote. But anyway, Carter, you know, had in 1976 an opportunity, and he seized it and campaigned brilliantly. And but he was campaigning not on the issues, but on the man, on himself.
And even though the political circumstances were so unusual in 1976, it does seem to me that Jimmy Carter helped to establish a new brand of politics that really did stick. What I mean by that is politicians from that point forward felt pressure to say something about religion, to pose at least, even if they were not genuinely, as outsiders to the Washington establishment. Was Jimmy Carter, in your view, a pioneer in this sense of a brand of American politics that we've come to see ever since?
Well, I think he, you know, even in retrospect, he without any doubt is the most decent man to have occupied the White House in the 20th century. You know, he really is, he was untouched by any personal scandal. He was devoted to trying to, in an intelligent way, working very hard, reading 300, 400 pages of memos every day in the White House. He wanted to figure out what's the smart, right thing to do on any policy issue. And he was very hardworking. He got into the Oval Office, you know, at 6:30 in the morning and worked 12 hours and then would come back later at night after an official dinner or whatnot and work even longer hours. And I think, you know, none of our most recent presidents have had that kind of a working schedule, or none of them have brought the intelligence to the hardworking intelligence to figuring out what is the right thing to do. So I think that's most unusual. And I think with the passage of time, you know, history is going to look more kindly on Carter.
He's hard to position ideologically it seems to me. One of the most striking things about your book were the, to me at least, were the passages about his relationships with Ted Kennedy, with Tip O'Neill, in other words, with the embodiments of that old liberal establishment in Washington. In a nutshell, he didn't get along very well with these characters. Talk a little bit about his place within the Democratic Party and the difficulties he had in maneuvering in Washington once he arrived there as this outsider.
Yeah, he had a terrible relationship with Ted Kennedy. He had a good working relationship with Tip O'Neill, but with Kennedy, it was, you know, bad chemistry. Carter just thought of Ted Kennedy as this entitled, privileged aristocrat who thought that he would, you know, had deserved the presidency because of his Boston Brahmin background and his assassinated brother. And they actually, you know, were, they had the same issue. They came to the same place on many issues. Food stamps for the poor, environmental issues. But, and for instance, on they both agreed that they were in support of national health care, national health insurance. Both had campaigned on this. Ted Kennedy had sort of made it his issue, but they had a terrible falling out over health care because Carter, while he had supported the idea, the notion of a national health insurance bill, when he got into office, the fiscal conservative in him kicked in and he said, he told Kennedy, you know, we don't have the federal budget to finance your massive single-payer program. And he proposed as a compromise a national health insurance for catastrophic health events, which would have guaranteed that no American family would spend more than $5,000 for a health crisis. And Carter argued that this would be a foot in the door and that gradually over the years that such a program would be allowed to expand to be something like Medicare for all. Kennedy rejected any compromise, and Carter believed he rejected it out of pure political opportunism. He wanted the health care issue as something that he could campaign on. And he realized as early as 1978, when actually one Senator Joe Biden came to him in the Oval Office and said, you know, I think Ted Kennedy is going to run against you for the nomination. And indeed, that's what happened. And they just, you know, and Kennedy, you know, Carter was determined, again, the ruthless political politician, and he announced that he was going to kick Kennedy's ass, and he did in the primaries. But Kennedy stayed on in the campaign to the very end, to right up to the convention, and divided the party as they went into the general election. And that's one of the reasons, of course, that Carter lost.
Healthcare, it seems to me, stands out as one of the tragic failures of the Carter administration for reasons that you go into great detail about in the book. But generally, it seems to me, you are eager in the study to call attention to some of Carter's perhaps less known accomplishments in the realm of domestic policy. Before we turn to foreign policy, let's stay there for just a minute. How would you appraise Carter's overall record in the domestic arena?
Well, he actually accomplished quite a bit. He passed more domestic legislation than Bill Clinton or Obama. He, you know, was in the White House at a time when the Democrats controlled both the House and the Senate. He passed legislation, for instance, that rescued Social Security, putting it on a fiscally stable path. He passed all sorts of deregulation of bills that deregulated the airline industry, the railroad industry, trucking. He appointed a staunch supporter of Ralph Nader as head of the government's consumer rights agency, which instituted for the first time mandatory seat belts and forced the automakers to build airbags into their cars. Both of these measures continually have saved probably 10,000 American lives a year. He grappled with the federal budget deficit. And, he famously was president during a time when interest rates skyrocketed to the double digits. And yet he actually did the tough political decision to appoint Paul Volcker to the Federal Reserve, being told by all his aides that Paul Volcker was someone who was going to jack up interest rates even higher and restrict the money supply and just bring the economy down to a terrible recession just as Carter was running for re-election. So it was a very politically courageous thing to do, and it did break the back of inflation eventually, but it didn't really achieve that until 2 years into Ronald Reagan's presidency. So he doesn't get credit for it.
It's sometimes claimed, it seems to me, that Jimmy Carter was unlucky in that some of these trends over which he had very little control really bit into his popularity during his presidency. Yeah. Would you go along with that claim?
Oh, yeah. He was very unlucky historically. Inflation came about because of not anything that he did, but it came about because of the Vietnam War and the energy crises, the big hike in prices of natural resources like oil and gas in the early 70s before he became president. And he was unlucky in terms of foreign policy, too, and just because of the Iranian revolution that occurred in late 78, early 79. And then this led, of course, to the Iranian hostage crisis that lasted 444 days and that just really weakened Carter politically. And yet Carter, even on foreign policy, we haven't talked about that much, but he had enormous achievements. Camp David, bringing peace between Israel and Egypt, the Panama Canal Treaty, SALT II, and Camp David in particular just never would have happened without the personal, relentless diplomacy of Jimmy Carter.
At the end of the day, enormous though Jimmy Carter's contributions may have been, might he have been a more effective president, and certainly might we think about him in different ways, if he had been a little more savvy about politics and a little less quick to put principle above politics in these difficult issues?
Oh, absolutely. I remember at one point in one of my interviews with him, I asked him if he thought it had been a mistake to turn down so many dinner invitations from Katharine Graham, the publisher of the Washington Post. And he sort of laughed and said, yes, that was definitely a mistake. he turned down those invitations because he was bored at those Georgetown cocktail parties and considered them to be a waste of his time. And he'd rather be in his little side office off to the side of the Oval Office where he'd spend a lot of his time listening to classical music and reading memos. But the Georgetown set just, they couldn't figure out this Southerner, the accent. They made fun of him, and he made no effort to sort of reach out to him. And he could have, he could have won them over if he'd just spent a little time with them. Yeah. He could have dealt better with Ted Kennedy. I argue in the book he should have trapped Kennedy by agreeing to support his bill on the healthcare issue because he knew that it didn't have the votes anyway, and so it would go down to defeat. And then after Kennedy was defeated for his bill, he could have proposed his compromise catastrophic healthcare bill. And he wasn't very astute politically, and he was impatient with glad-handing politics, and he was unwilling to sort of wheel and deal and allow a little pork barrel to get through in order to win on other issues. And this, you know, this made him a less effectual politician and president than he could have been.
More than any other issue, Iran really dogged Jimmy Carter, particularly in the final stages of his presidency. And to some extent, as you mentioned a few minutes ago, he was the victim of unfortunate timing. This set of events came to a crescendo under Jimmy Carter's watch. But you're also in the book somewhat critical of some of his decisions, at least in connection with the Iran crisis. Would you talk a little bit about the decisions that he made that might be subject to criticism?
Sure. You know, it was a very tough issue, what to do about the Iranian Revolution. I don't think he could have stopped it. It was an organic thing that was going to happen. The Shah was becoming more and more unpopular and distant from his people. And once the revolution got going, there was no way to stop it. But for a moment, he, in late 78, he, under pressure from his national security advisors, Zbigniew Brzezinski, who was a real Cold War hawk, Brzezinski urged him to try to consider giving a green light to an attempted coup, having the Iranian military intervene and try to, you know, violently suppress the demonstrations in the streets. And Carter, you know, allowed Brzezinski to explore these options and got pushback from our ambassador in Iran. And it was never really a serious possibility. It was just not practical. But he did explore the option. And so there was some missteps. And then, you know, when the hostages were taken, this became a real albatross politically. And his advisors, including Brzezinski, urged him to use military force to maybe mine the harbors or have an airstrike. And Carter said, no, I don't want to do anything that would endanger the lives of the hostages. And finally, in April of 1980, months into the hostage crisis, after many attempts to negotiate, to use diplomacy to get the hostages out, Carter finally agreed to Brzezinski's lobbying to have a rescue mission mounted, the famous helicopter rescue mission. And this was, I think, I argue in the book, a big mistake. It was an operation that was doomed to failure. There were too many moving parts. It was too complicated. If they'd actually gotten into Tehran, the helicopters hadn't misfired, there would have been a massacre of Iranian civilians. Many of the hostages probably would have been lost. And in any case, it didn't happen. It was a failure, and it greatly, again, weakened Carter, leaving many Americans with the perception that he was weak and ineffectual and inept. It was just an utter disaster. But Carter gave a green light to this operation because, you know, he was so frustrated with how long the crisis had dragged on. So,
if not for Iran, could Jimmy Carter plausibly have won re-election in 1980?
Oh, yes. You know, people recall, in most Americans' memory, you know, this was a landslide election. Well, it turned out that way in the Electoral College in particular. But up until 2 weeks before the election, Carter was within 4 or 5 percentage points in the polls. And if he hadn't had if the hostages had been released, in a, quote, October surprise, that might have changed things. If Kennedy hadn't run against him, that might have changed things. And if Carter hadn't appointed Paul Volcker to jack up interest rates, he might have had a better economy to run on. But, you know, these are all what ifs. But there is, I do argue very controversially in the book, I devote a whole chapter to quote, the October surprise, which briefly to summarize is the notion that perhaps one Bill Casey, the campaign manager for Ronald Reagan, who was later appointed CIA director, perhaps Bill Casey had made a secret trip to Madrid, Spain in the summer of 1980 and had a meeting with a representative of the Ayatollah Khomeini and essentially said, you know, there's no need to make a deal right away on releasing the hostages because Ronald Reagan will give you a better deal. And this was actually investigated by journalists and by Congress in the 1990s, but I think I found a smoking gun memo that proves that actually Casey did go to Madrid, Spain, and for purposes unknown. And I think he did meet with an Iranian representative of the Ayatollah. And if so, it's an egregious interference in U.S. foreign policy. And it prolonged the hostage crisis and helped to elect Ronald Reagan.
Yeah, fascinating chapter. In your conclusion, you say Jimmy Carter, at the end of his presidency, had changed the country. And we've touched on various ways in which Jimmy Carter had changed the country. But reflect broadly, if you would, on that claim. In what key areas did Jimmy Carter change the country?
Well, domestically, I think the big thing was sort of the deregulation of key sectors of the economy. So middle-class Americans, for the first time, began to be able to afford to fly because of the deregulation of the airline industry. And then in terms of foreign policy, the biggest long-lasting legacy is that Carter put at the center, as the centerpiece of our foreign policy, human rights and the principle of human rights. And while, you know, it's been difficult to implement, and while even Carter was accused sometimes of hypocrisy, No American president has been able to walk away from the notion that America should be concerned about human rights, whether it's in the old Soviet Union or in Russia today, or in Israel today, or in Egypt today. These are festering issues that just won't go away. And Carter, you know, as part of his sort of moral sensibility, insisted that we have to talk about human rights. We can't simply have a foreign policy that is based on realpolitik and national self-interest. We have to take seriously our American ideals, even in the field of foreign affairs. And that's a long-lasting legacy and an important one, I think.
Surely Jimmy Carter has the most extraordinary post-presidency of any American president. And you chronicle briefly at the end of your book that's mostly focused on the presidency itself, many of the initiatives and projects that Jimmy Carter has undertaken in recent years. How do you explain where the drive came from to do all of this over the last decades of Jimmy Carter's life? Is this just that same energy that propelled him to the White House in the first place?
That's one answer, but it's also, you know, his religiosity. Mm-hmm. This is his faith, and he takes his religion seriously, and he tries to, it's sort of an old-time Southern Baptist faith. He strongly believes in the separation of church and state, which is one reason why he took away tax-exempt status of these white academies that were segregated in the South, that alienated many, in fact, evangelicals, his own constituency. And so, you know, he was willing to do things that were politically damaging to himself only because he believed they were the right thing to do. And, you know, you have to respect that. It explains his ex-presidency too, his willingness to devote so many hours and so much energy to trying to wipe out a guinea worm disease, a very obscure but horrible disease that afflicts poor people in Africa and Latin America, and he succeeded. Now, there were millions of cases of guinea worm disease when he started every year, and now it's down to less than a dozen. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he famously says he wants to live out his life. He doesn't want to die until the last guinea worm dies. And, you know, he does the same, you know, he did the same thing with regard to human rights and in terms of his ex-presidency by all this election monitoring. The Carter Center has gone out to places in monitoring elections in Nicaragua or Ethiopia or Nepal. And, no one else does this, and it's important work, and it's a direct extension of his presidency. Sort of one of the reasons why the title of the book is The Outlier, The Unfinished Presidency of Jimmy Carter, because once he was defeated, that didn't mean that his work, his good works, stopped. He continued to work on those issues, the same issues he'd worked in the White House.
In fact, Kai, I think you do a wonderful job of showing various ways in which Jimmy Carter was ahead of his times, thinking about issues that perhaps would only really become obvious in much later decades, including even in our own era in 2022. Let me ask you in conclusion, are there any particular implications or lessons that you would draw from Jimmy Carter's presidency that you think we would be well advised to remember in 2022?
Oh, yeah, a host of issues. I mean, he was, even as a president, he was sort of a prophet in the wilderness. But, you know, he was the first president to start talking about climate change. He issued this rather radical report that laid out the issue very late in his presidency. He was a strong supporter of national health care, and that is still an issue that's of concern to many Americans. Obamacare is a big step forward, but it's not the end. Human rights, his fear, his concern about nuclear weapons is now suddenly right smack in front of us with this Ukraine crisis. It's unbelievable, but we are, I think, facing an even more dangerous possibility that tactical nuclear weapons could be used and in my lifetime. And I find that to be an astonishing thing. And, you know, Carter tried to talk about the dangers of these weapons when he was in the White House. And so he's always been sort of a prophet in the wilderness. And again, I think with time, history is going to look back upon him as someone who was not only a decent and intelligent president, but someone who had a vision for and something that we could learn from.
Well, Kai Bird, thank you so much for being with us today and sharing your insights into the 39th president, Jimmy Carter. Congratulations on this wonderful book. Really appreciate your being with us today.
Thank you, Mark. It was a lot of fun.
My thanks to our sponsors, the Moody Foundation and St. David's Healthcare, and as always, to you for joining us. If you've enjoyed this episode, subscribe, rate, and review us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. I'm Mark Lawrence. See you next time.